Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Sarah Majuli, and we're across from Marcus Zusak, who's coming to talk about his long-awaited Bridge of Clay, his new novel, which Sarah and I have read and we think is extraordinary. Just up front, we will say that because we'll take the pressure off. Both of us are just in love with this book. Thank you so much for finishing it. Thank you so much for coming and visiting Booktopia.
It's great to be here.
You've been looking forward to this visit. Probably.
Well, it's half of my motivation for finishing the book. All these other writers I know are saying, oh, yeah, I went out to Booktopia.
You heard it here, everyone.
Just rub it in my face again that you're coming to sign books at Booktopia. So I finally had my moment. Frankly, I think I did it quicker than anybody else. I'm not competitive at all.
You've got it down. You have. Yeah. Now, this is a long-awaited book, and you've been getting already good reviews. What sort of state were you in as you came towards this period of the proof copy going out and of the of first readers and reviewers and booksellers getting a first look of it? Were you at home rocking on the floor, or what was the...
Yeah, I was in my usual state, which is disorganized. You always feel like you're going to be prepared and you're going to do this right and you're going to do that right. And I'm always saying to myself, prepare well, get everything done in a good amount of time and all that sort of thing. But then everything just rushes up at you. And so by the time it got to proofs going out and all that kind of thing, I was, you know, I was just doing 100 other things. And yeah, I'm pretty nervous, but at the same time, it's done. And I'm actually, the one thing that I know is that the book is itself in a way that everything is deliberate in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the decisions, I will not hide behind running short of time. You can't after 13 years or rushing things, even though you do rush things at the end, you know, and things, you know, you're doing edits here and edits for other countries and things like that. So you do get pressed for time, but everything is how I wanted it to be, even though I still think there'll be 20% improvement for this book till the day I die. But I'm not going to hide behind any excuses. It's how I wanted it to be, and I think it does take a little bit of commitment to read it, and it's a bit harder to read probably than my previous books. But I hope the rewards are greater too.
Oh, they certainly are.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how you, if you get stopped in the street and someone says, Marcus, what's your new book about? How do you present the book to others in this period in your sort of short
yeah. shot? Well, it's actually really hard to, it's always, you know, as you know, it's the hardest question. What's your book about? And then you do these practice runs at home or with friends or whatever, and they go, that told me nothing. And so in this case, you know, I would just say, you know, it's about a family, really. And it's about a boy in that family who takes it upon himself to kind of bring that family back together. And he does that by building a bridge with his dad. And he leaves his four brothers behind to do it. So there's always a lot at stake. And just the idea that his brothers might not let him back into the house because his dad left them. And so I wanted to put a character into a position where he felt like he had to do something great and something he wants to make one beautiful and perfect thing, kind of knowing that he can't, but he does it anyway. And that's what is beautiful and great. And I think we all feel like that. We want to make, you know, the sort of, I don't want to say metaphor, but just the analogy is that idea of, you know, you've got Michelangelo's statue of David, which is this prince, you know, it's this beautiful, perfect thing. But at the gallery where, or the museum where you go and see that, there are these slaves on the way in that are unfinished, and they're struggling to get out of the marble in a way. And I think that's more how we live our lives.
They're gorgeous, wow. Those things. When you walk down that corridor, they were the most attractive things to me in the whole building.
And so many people don't even see them. And that's even better. And so when you do, you kind of feel like you feel kind of privileged that you noticed them.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, they've always captivated me.
It's like the struggle to get these stories out, you know, because you never really feel like Michelangelo looking back on that corridor going, every book that you've done is kind of like a slave trying to get out. You did pretty well to get most of it out. But, you know, yeah. There's always that unfinished, as you were saying, that extra 20% you could go back and work on.
The difference is he's Michelangelo. And so he could scratch a few things on the wall over there and it'd be, you know, the greatest thing you've ever seen. I could put 13 years into a book and go, that's still rubbish.
It's a high benchmark that comparison. You're setting yourself.
Yeah, Lou Reed's things, you can't be Shakespeare, you can't be Joyce, what is left instead.
Yeah, just toil away and hope for the best. But I think you come to terms with that in the end, where you just say, the greatest things my dad ever said to me, even though my mum argues with him over it, I love coming from a family full of arguments. That's one of the things that's, you know, led me to be the writer that I am. But I remember losing a race once when I was a kid at athletics and they put me in sixth position at the end. And I complained to my mum and dad and they said, yeah, well, we thought you actually won as well, but you made one big mistake. You didn't win by enough. You got to win by so much that they can't take it off you. Yeah. And I think of that in writing and coming back to what you're talking about there is I don't try to write better than anyone else or outdo anyone or, you know, try to have any argument like that, but I try to write so much like myself that only I could have written that. And I think certainly in the case of a book like The Book Thief and now Bridge of Clay, I sort of feel like only I could have written those books, and you have to be satisfied with that as a writer within yourself, not people out there. Yeah, you should just be bloody satisfied. No, that's not what I mean.
You as the creator.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I mean, it's such a glorious book, a big, beautiful, Australian, grand book. Did take 13 years. Has it changed a lot over that time? Like, did it go through a lot of different mutations?
Well, it's funny. It's narrated by Matthew Dunbar, Clay's oldest brother. It was, for the first 6 years, narrated by a girl who lived across the street. It was actually Kerry Novak's sister.
Oh, I've got so many questions here.
So Kerry Novak, being Clay's best friend, had this younger sister who was always envying Kerry. And this gives you an idea of just the sorts of problems you have writing a book, just letting that narrator go. She was just never quite the right narrator. And then I had Matthew, then I had every brother in the family narrated it. I was just having trouble with the voice all the time. And then when I changed to Matthew, then I had a new problem. So you always think you're going to solve your problem, but you just get a whole set of new problems. That's what I say to people who think you've got to be some sort of genius to be a writer or you've got to be really creative. I say, I'm not really that creative. I just have a lot of problems. And your creativity is getting around the problem. And the problem I then had, I nearly wrote Kerry Novak out of the book because she was such a hard character to get right because she was just then too perfect. And that made sense when you had her sister, Maggie, who envied her. So she was perfect, Kerry. But when it was Matthew, Clay's brother, writing about her that way, she became really bland. Mm. And so I had to make her less, not attractive, but I had to make her less at ease with the world. Like, you know, Kerry would do things and she'd just be able to do it. And I had to make her struggle more. And so she had to get her hands dirty a lot more. And in the end, I can't imagine the book without her, of course. And she's such an important part of Clay's life.
I couldn't imagine it without her.
I'm wondering, did it always have this... Because you talk about Homer in the book, you talk about Michelangelo, you talk about these big, epic kind of people. And I, in my mind, I was waiting for... the music to kick in, like a big opera. The first opera in the Shire. and it seemed to me that there was a lot of method behind the scenes. How much planning goes... Because it seemed really planned. Like I only think of this as a writer after reading.
Mm.
And I go back and go, how the hell did you do this?
Because when you're in it, you're just living in this world and it's going this way and that way. And
but it does have, everything is big. Like it just feels big. Was that something that you had an intention of going into an Australian story and go, I'm going to make an Australian story that's big?
I think so. when I finished The Book Thief, I thought to myself, so this is the difference between writing books that really mean something to you and writing a book that means everything to you. And I went, I only want to write books that mean everything to me, and I only want to write books that I'm not sure I can write. Now, after this one, I think I'm ready to write a book that just means something to me again. I felt like, you know, I want to bet bigger. Like, I want to bet more. I want to bet more. And so all the times when I was cutting brothers out of the book at one point. I nearly seen this shows you again.
Like,
you'll have a run at writing writing the book with just Matthew and Clay. As you try everything, and you know what that's like. And then the problem then is you've got Matthew and Clay, who are the most alike. And you go, oh, this is all one colour now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and you couldn't really believe that they would be silly enough to have a mule and all those animals. But to come back to the question, yeah, I did. I wanted to bet really big. And the idea of Homer and Michelangelo, they just seem to fit. I mean, Homer came into the book purely because I just had these boys. Like, you think, what does modern-day Australia have to do with ancient Greece? And then the first thing you go is, Homer was just great with nicknames, as are Australians. And so, you know, and I love that. If you go back and read the Iliad or the Odyssey, and it's so overwrought, but in this really joyous kind of way. And you can even see, I mean, you two can see my face as I talk about it. Like, I just have genuine joy talking about, and I don't want to say literature that way, but just that kind of, you know, the personality and the character and the love of story that comes through those books. And, you know, but I love how Odysseus isn't just Odysseus. He's always the resourceful Odysseus. Achilles has several, he's Achilles of the nimble feet and or the fast-running Achilles, and Zeus is the cloud compeller. And you just go, oh, God, I love that. And that's why, you know, Clay's the smiler. You know, and Rory, probably my favourite nickname, is the human ball and chain. He's the guy who stops you. And they can be simple, like Tom is the youngest one. But I think what I wanted to do was to have that idea of aspiration, and that Clay, you know, you don't have to have a deep rooted tragedy to make you want to make great things, but it helps. And I think in stories it helps. And you're always, you know, I mean, I always knew, but I'm hoping the reader is thinking, what is it that is driving Clay to this? What is it? What is the secret that he's holding that makes him want to make something great in a way, or make a miracle as a cure for the pain?
I think you are driven through by those questions, but you've also created this, and it's partly because of having Homer in there, but it's also this sense that you're in a legend, like maybe a smaller family legend, but you've got your mistake maker and you've got your smiler, and you feel as though you're going through your own little legend. Like, you didn't ever even question why they're obsessed with these stories, because of course they are. Like,
yeah, I think it's just, that's what families are. Yeah. Families are myth making.
Yeah.
And, and families are, oh, I remember when you fell in the river that time, and then you chased me for an hour and vowed to get me, you know, whatever it is. I wanted to bring that big story into the confines of suburbia.
Mm.
And even, you know, that sort of racing quarter, you know, and even the idea that there's horse racing in the book, and the horse racing is in the book for one reason, and that is because I knew that Achilles, the mule, was going to be a big character in the book. And I went, oh, I had it, but I wanted it to be set in a city for the most part. And I went, oh, so, okay, what if it's in? And I went back to those sort of Melbourne Cup stories that you'd hear about, some of the overseas horses coming and they're traveling with a Shetland pony because that's their companion animal. So I thought of, you know, when you go to stables and things like that, and there's always some animal that's living there that's just the mascot of the place. And so it's amazing what you will do in a book as a not as a means to, you don't want it to simply be a means to an end, but often some of your more creative choices or your more inspired choices are there because purely because you need them. And so all of that, that so and the horse racing element brought another sort of element of myths because, you know, that's what we do with sport in Australia, but particularly that sport. You know, and so you've got, I like stumbling across different legends as well. Like I really, I love the story of the horse Peter Pan, which was, you know, could for all intents and purposes be as famous as Farlap. Mm. And it's great finding the unknown legends as well.
I love that. I mean, maybe lots of people know this, but I didn't love that. Sorry, I didn't know the story about Farlap and the guy who was like, well, what does this matter on a day that Farlap died?
It's a great story.
That was such a good story.
There was more in there about horse racing, but I had to take it out. Everyone was going, too much horse racing. Because you don't want it to become an exercise in showing how much you know. And some people would still argue that there is too much horse racing in the book. But it's how you get to know Carrie, who is an apprentice jockey. And, you know, that's her world and she's showing that world to Clay. It's how they bond, actually.
And it fits in the theme, I feel like, because it's another way of looking on the surface of things. Like, I'm not a person who's hugely knows much about horse racing.
Mm.
And to me, when I think of horse racing, I think of it on TVs in pubs and
yeah.
kind of a modern kind of view of horse racing. In this book, it comes through as this, like, thing that has been going on forever and there's all this myth and legend to it, and you can imagine the horses racing around the track with chariots, like, you know, like it all sort of fits together
well. And you don't, and you sort of find out about three quarters of the way through the book that unless you have a knowledge of it, that all the streets are named after great champions. And Poseidon Road, the main street of the race, as it's called, you never find out the name of their actual suburb. It's just in the racing quarter. And but Poseidon Road was once called Kingston Road. But then I went, no, because Kingston Town ran in the 80s. And so you just go, all right, I've got to go. So I went back to much older horses. And Poseidon just fit in with the legendary, and he was a great horse way, way, way back. And it was just nice having all of those, you know, so that you've got a story in, but it's built on something.
Yeah.
And people can either notice that or not. But it's nice to know that it's there.
As someone from a big family, and you're one of four, I'm one of five, to be the way in which you've got those brothers working, I'm the oldest of three brothers, and the physicality that these boys have and the urgency of the competition, like it can't be won until a certain point, and until the oldest brother gets decrepit. there's no winning.
And the younger ones just know what they have to.
Yeah, and that also tied in with the whole legend thing, because they felt like gods, these boys. You know,
yeah, right.
In which they consistently competed, and it was so physical, and it reminded me so much. There's no malice or like it's when people see this stuff, when people see boys from afar being boys and being aggressive and inside it, like often there's no malice at all. It's just, I want to get hurt. I want to prove myself in this moment. You capture it so brilliantly in this.
We were talking before the podcast about how you describe them as a comic book kapow of boys. And I just thought that was so perfect because it's violent, but it's not malicious.
No.
And I just imagine them all around the table eating without their shirts on. Like, you just fall in love with these boys.
Was that real? Was that something from your past?
Well, that came from, and this is when I was really suffering writing the book, and my wife made me quit. She said, you got a week to get this back on track and to get happy again. And then when I did start again after taking a month or so off, all the joy for the fight, and I think that's what you're talking about too with that sort of brothers. It's not, people often talk about it. It's not the end result. It's the process and all of that. And I feel like that's what, you know, being in a big family is about. It's just you're always tussling. And I was the same, but I was, you know, getting sparks of joy again when I started writing because I'd lost the book. And then you don't know what you've got until you've lost it. And when I started writing again, there was a moment where, you know, it was a hot day and I was just cleaning something and I just took my T-shirt off to just do the last bit. And my son, who was about 4 at the time, or 5, came around the corner and he saw me and he said, oh, hey, Dad, what are you doing here in just your nipples? And it's the exact line Tommy says in the book. And then that led, and that's the great thing about, it's what I love about writing fiction, is you have that moment and you go, oh, what a great thing. And he says that exact thing. And then you build on it, yeah. And then you make more out of it. And then I got to that bit where, oh, their parents make them eat without their shirts, and then there's the line where Michael says, their dad says, oh, well, what about your mum? Because he takes his off. Should she take hers off? And Clay says no, but she does actually do it. And it was one of those descriptions, is that she's sitting there in her, you know, she's in a bra that's about, you know, probably 20 years old, and getting the description of that, right? First it was broken, and then you know what it's like. You go through and do a word search, you go, God, there's a lot of broken in this book, and it ended up being described as scruffy.
Yeah.
And that they knew what to get her for Christmas because clearly she needed a new one. But just that, the physicality of the brothers, there's a line where it's said, well, there are a couple of lines that I think you have your favourite moments, like the comic book kapow of brothers and boys. Is sort of, there are a few lines that you love that, in a sense, until it's no longer viable, you almost write your book around those lines. And one of the ones from the book is when Matthew says, it's a mystery even to me how boys and brothers love, and I think that's kind of true.
Mm.
And the other thing he says is that he came past me, but they always touch, and he says, you know, that, you know, we don't mind touching elbows, knuckles, shoulders, arms. There was a bit where even hearts was mentioned, and it was just that bit too much, but I cut that.
Mm.
So I was just trimming the bits of fat off it right to the very end.
It feels, I mean, as a writer myself, looking at the way you've put this together, even the way you line up the sentences on the page, and the small little tiny bits that just slotted in, it all works. It all works in so beautiful. But there's, I said it before when I was doing the signing, that I freaking hated you for so many times. You put two words together that I would never ever have conceived as being okay in the one sentence,
and
right next
so
to each other.
Perfect, and if you feel,
and
like
they make new meaning.
Yeah,
it's just how, like, is that those moments of inspiration, or are you conscious about trying to find in that particular moment? I need something which is unique to Matthew's way of talking about this, or unique to that family.
It's funny when with my editor here, she would say, here's another example of Matthew doing this. and she said, I'm going to get a t-shirt printed that said, with, you know, and it became a bit of a running joke of, you know, there was one that says, we're going to get a t-shirt printed that says deliberately different. And I'd say, that's deliberately different to how it's normally done. And the other one, what was the other one? It's just how Matthew talks, okay? Because it was things like he would say something, like, and it's almost the way I speak, maybe. But I just, I'm just trying to think of, it could be something as simple as, it was perfect, really.
Mm.
And someone will go, what was perfect? I'll say, yeah, the answer's on the next line.
Keep going.
So why does he have to say it now? And really, you know from reading it that something is written somewhere, and or just something's just said, and you get the answer to it 300 pages later.
Mm.
And so I just that level of planning, it, like I said earlier, everything was deliberate. And, I mean, but when it comes to those sort of word choices or sentence choices, it's a combination. Yeah. It's a combination of being extremely meticulous, extremely deliberate. And the one thing I think you're always searching for is, I mean, I know what I want. I know what I want, but the thing is, it hasn't formed yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm forever searching for it. And then when I get it, I'm really happy. But at the same time, I love that you do so much work as a writer that you're working and working. It's a bit like climbing a mountain, but there's the promise of a sandpit at the top. where you get to play. But you don't know when you're going to hit the top. And so, I mean, my favourite line from any book ever, or one of my favourites, is from Michael Chabon's The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, where he talks about a big ocean liner coming into New York, and it's called the Rotterdam. And he says, the Rotterdam came into New York Harbor like a mountain wearing a dinner jacket.
Oh, that's so good.
And you go, that's a guy who's done all the work and he's in the sand pit playing. And, you know, you don't get to play for long, but then it comes and you go, oh, I really like that line. And, you know, the comic book Kapow is, you know, that description of the family is one of those moments. And yet it actually... you realise that he's mentioning it because, you know, in part three, it's there's a point where he's talking about his dad as a little boy sitting in a doctor's surgery where his mum worked and reading through the comic books and all that, you know, and the comic book Kapow, and it's their Kapows and criminals and everything else. So everything always sort of comes back.
I had another one as well, actually, like, because obviously I think everyone who reads this is going to fall in love with Clay and fall in love with Matthew, but then it's like, who's your favorite out of the remaining brothers? And I really liked Rory. So hearing that you had a go at having everyone be the narrator, I'm most interested to hear his narration. But at some point you describe him as Puck with fists, and that was another thing that just clicked in my head, and I was like, yes, in a way you've been describing him that way the whole way through the book, but then when you get to that moment, it's just encapsulated, like, with a few little words.
People love Rory. It's such a funny thing because he's one of the characters that I always sort of went, are people really getting a clear picture of him? Because he's even though he's described with his rusty sort of hair and his scrap metal eyes, and I think you've got to trust the reader that they're going to bring their own imagination to him as well. But and just all the tussles he has with all the animals, and, you know, the cat Hector is lying on his throat strangling him, and all that sort of stuff is just, you know, Henry and Rory are kind of there for comic relief in a lot of cases because, you know, terrible things happen to this family, and yet they're a nice, they shine a bit of laughter onto things. And I don't know who, I mean, I've never thought of categorising the brothers in that sort of way and who's my favourite brother. But in the end, Matthew is my favourite. And I know, because I feel like it's a book that builds and builds and comes back and forth and back. It's a bit like a tide all the way until finally you hit the end. And when you get to the epilogue, and it was interesting because that Pan, and so my publisher did ask me to do the audio for the book, and I think it was the perfect way to finish the whole project. And I don't think of it as a project. It's my life, this book, you know. And but when I read the last couple of chapters in the epilogue, all through doing the reading of the audio, I'd say, oh, I got that bit wrong, or I was too fast there. But at the end, I'd be saying, oh, his voice got really shaky there. And I think Matthew's my favourite because I think especially by the end of the book, you see why he's writing it. And it's because he loves Clay and he just wants him to come home. You know, and I still get really teary when I read that epilogue. And, you know, I guess because I know how much work has gone into it and I've lived that life for 13 years in the writing of it. But so I just see how much he loves Clay, and that's why he's my favorite. Not that the others don't, but
I think you can't not. I mean, Matthew and Clay are so central in this story, but you can't. I couldn't imagine it without any of them. No. I'm so glad you didn't cut any.
Well,
of them.
when I did try to write with only the two brothers, I mean, that lasts an hour or 2 hours, and you go, oh, there's something missing here. And the other thing too is after 13 years, if I wanted it to have, you know, if it turned out to be a novella, fine, you know, it has to be what it needs to be. But this book needed to be a hopefully well-planned, meticulous, yet sprawling
saga,
suburban tale. And, you know, it certainly does sprawl. And it certainly does, you know, it go off on tangents and comes back and forth. But you know, I kind of, in the end, I'm at peace with it now.
Thank you so much for coming and talking to us, Marcus. It's been an absolute pleasure. And you could just hear the sound of Sarah's next question.
I know. I forgot about it. Backed up.
But. No, it's been great being here, and I've loved every moment. And, this was just great. I better write another book.
Yeah,
great. In a hurry.
I applaud that decision.
As we said at the beginning, we both loved it, and we really recommend that everyone get a hold of it right away. Not that we need to do that, because people are just going to be running for this book. So congratulations, Marcus.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
And you can get hold of Marcus's new book, Bridge of Clay, at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.